You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll learn about Color in the Outdoors, a Wisconsin organization that's encouraging marginalized groups to get outside and enjoy outdoor activities. Now, there's a new exhibit coming to the Museum of Wisconsin Art, Mirroring Reflection. Features paintings by Kahari Turner, originally from Milwaukee. Turner says he wants his work to celebrate his ancestors. Part of the way he does that is by using water from lakes, rivers, and oceans that have a connection to Black history. Kahari Turner joins us now. His new exhibit opens at the Museum of Wisconsin Art in West Bend on the last Saturday of April. Kahari, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, take us through what this exhibit will look like if we show up on opening day on the 30th.
Oh, honestly, it's really interesting. So there's a lot of different colors. There's a lot of different kind of ways to explore the work. But essentially what you'll see is a lot of different figurative and then non-figurative or abstract kind of mixing of painting and water and ocean water and the things that I use in all of my work kind of put together in a way, kind of like a family portrait or a family reunion of sorts in a painting style.
And who's that family?
It's kind of all over the place. The way that I think about my work is more of like a abstract person as well, like a ancestral, but then maybe universal type figure. So essentially it could be anybody, and it could maybe be somebody you know, or it could be your next door neighbor. But the point is that, you know, you connect to the person as a body of water to another body of water, which is the painting. Like, everybody's made up of water, so we should all connect through water in one way or another.
Yeah, can you talk about the element of water in your work? On a practical side, you're going out to lakes and rivers and oceans and collecting the water that's going to end up in your paint?
Yeah, exactly. So I'll go out to different places, including like Lake Michigan, which is one of the Great Lakes, and it's right next to my home. And then think about the connection to me and me just being a person. And what does it mean to have Lake Michigan and Lake Michigan water run through me as a person? Like, I drink water that's, you know, sourced through Lake Michigan, as well as, you know, we drink water from all over these places. And so that connection to water is really just one of those things that it unifies everybody, because, you know, one way or another, everybody's a part of this water, especially the Great Lakes. There's so much water that people drink that are coming from those areas, as well as all of the rivers that flow throughout the United States. And so I just go to those locations, kind of get a giant gallon of water, dip it into the water in one area or another, and take it back to my studio.
Does a painting have, a different personality if it came from a river or a Great Lake or an ocean or this river versus that river?
It's a little bit of a mix. So the way I do it is because of the salt in the ocean water and the ink that I use, the ink kind of floats on top of the ocean water. And then as it floats, the water will kind of move it however it wants to. And then what I'll do is I'll add fresh water from the lakes and rivers to kind of go in and push some of those things, push some of the ink out of the way. And so you kind of see in the work where the history of the water flowed on the painting. And as the painting dries, all of the ink stops and pretty much lets you know a whole story of what happened with the water, how the water influenced the work, and then how the water kind of finished off.
I read, I think it was in one of your statements, you want to celebrate your ancestors in your paintings. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us more about that part of your work?
Yeah, so one thing is, as a African-American or Black person in the United States, and being also a person who does not, you know his father, there's a lot of different things as far as like my own history that I don't know. And so in doing so, the people that I paint are that kind of that idea. Like, I know that they'll have some of the features that I'm painting, but they essentially could be anybody. And the point of the work is to be able to grab as many ideas of different people as possible and put them into a painting. So then it's really easy to not, you know, get stuck on, okay, maybe they look like this or maybe they look like this, but wait, they could look like anything, and the ability to look like anything is powerful. At least I hope so.
I wanted to ask about just kind of where the concept came from with the water and tying it into that ancestry and the history. Was this just like an epiphany that hit you all of a sudden, or just something you gradually developed? Like, I'm really curious about how that came about.
Yeah, it was kind of an epiphany on a weird scale. I was thinking about kind of abstraction and like figuration, or just like real versus not real, for a long time. And being from Milwaukee, the Great Lakes were right there. I spent a lot of time by water. And so I started thinking, like, what type of history do I have with water? And then what type of history would I want to talk about with water? And obviously, I could talk about all the different things that happened, all the boats that came to the United States, anything that happened in water, I could talk about, you know. And so I thought about that for a long time. But then during quarantine, that kind of first couple months, I ended up taking a trip out to California, and I was right next to the Pacific Ocean. And I was, you know, I've been thinking about water this whole time during quarantine. I was like, well, you know, I'm right over here. Let me put some water in a painting and just see what happens, you know, conceptually thinking about art in general. And when I put it in, I realized that it turned the medium, or it made the paint change. And once I saw that, I was like, oh, I gotta explore this way more. And so then it just happened.
I understand you hope to have an organization someday that gives back to young artists, people who are where you used to be. Can you say a little more about that?
Yeah, so I've been thinking about this a lot, actually. There's a lot of different ways that I want to do it. Right now, I'm looking into, like, hopefully within the next 5 years at least, to maybe build or work on creating community centers. There's a lot of different things that I felt like were really great for me growing up that I don't see anymore in the community. And I feel like those type of places where people can go and you know, be able to get resources and whatnot is very important. So I'm like thinking about a lot of different ways to give back in one way or another. Also doing ocean cleanups and then also teaching classes for youth and hoping that, you know, maybe my experience of coming from where I came from and, you know, making it how I'm making it right now will be inspiring in one way or another. Or at least helpful, for sure.
Can you give a shout out to something in Milwaukee in your youth that helped inspire you?
Yeah, there's a bunch of different places. Definitely a YMCA. I never mentioned that, but I was at the YMCA in Milwaukee. Lake Valley Camp, which is now Peak, is amazing. I went there for 13 odd years. So Lake Valley Camp, which is now Peak, shout out to them. They do amazing work in the community as well as work with so many children. And then I think that's it. I also took like classes at Brown Deer High School. So Brown Deer High School, they're out there. I took like swim lessons there when I was really young.
The water
and
the
actually
art.
And then I went to high school there. So it was great.
Kahari, thanks so much for sharing this with us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's artist Kahari Turner, originally from Milwaukee, talking to us about his upcoming exhibit. It's called Mirroring Reflection. It opens at the Museum of Wisconsin Art in West Bend on April 30th. It's going to run through early July. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with an answer to an audience question about a historic football team.
Gene Jansen wrote to Wisconsin about the Little Chute Flying Dutchman, a semi-pro football team that played for three decades, a mere 25 miles from Lambeau Field. He remembered the team from his youth and hoped to learn more about its history. With his help, WPR's Jenny Peek hit the archives to learn more.
When Gene Jansen was a boy, he spent many Sunday mornings helping ready the field for the Little Chute Flying Dutchman, his town's very own semi-pro football team.
We'd go to the lumber yard, and that's where we'd get the line, and at this machine and put the lines up, and all the yard markers had to be 17 and a half inches in from the sidelines, you know. And it took a long time because you had 50 yards one way and 50 yards going the other way.
That was in the late 1940s, but the team got its start in 1920. Over the years, the Flying Dutchman played teams across central and northeast Wisconsin, and while the Dutchmen were able to suit up as a team for 30 straight years, other teams came and went.
After the war, there was other teams that had not have a team because of the war, took a lot of their players away. Fortunately, in Little Chute, we were able to keep going because the St. John's High School was giving teams that the players could keep playing. And so a lot of those players went on to play for the Flying Dutchman.
So what were some of the teams the Flying Dutchman played?
The main four teams was Manitowoc Gales, the Two Rivers Ramblers, and Little Chute, and the Merrill Foxes. I think it was, believe, in 1938. Later on was the New London Edisons, the Clintonville four-wheeler drive truckers, and the Appleton Reds.
But the Dutchmen didn't just play semi-pro teams. Legend has it they also played the Green Bay Packers.
I was able to trace it to 1920. By talking to some of the guys, I heard it was 52-0 that Little Chute got whomped. However, when you read more, it shows where one of the teams actually beat the Packers. I think it was the 1935, you know, like an exhibition game or something like that. The only one of a semi-pro team that ever beat the Packers.
Jansen says fans of the Little Chute Flying Dutchman even tailgated like the Cheeseheads of today.
When they played ball at halftime, where did some of the crowd go at halftime? Where the heck are those guys going? Well, here they're going across the road about a block away, and this guy had a garage, and he had beer in that garage with coolers. And those guys would go over there and get a can of beer, you know. And he had his whole garage lined up with all different kinds of beer cans, different brands. I think that's how he got his collection.
The team disbanded in 1950. Jim Bunger is now 91, played toward the end of the Flying Dutchman's reign.
And I played with Dutchman 47, 48, 49. I played tackle and guard most of the time, both ways, on defense and offense.
But like many of his teammates, Bunger's had to eventually say goodbye to football.
In 50, I got married. Well, then football was over with for me. Yeah, I couldn't take a chance on getting hurt more or anything after I got married. Oh, I really enjoyed playing the football net. But it's just after you get married that you don't play that anymore.
Now 81, Jansen hopes to pass along some of the history he remembers so fondly.
Like I said, it was crowds like sometimes 3,000 people at that game because, you know, years ago, there was no television, you know, and that's how it was. Everybody went to a game. People followed everything. And now it's hard to get people to get involved, even volunteering, you know. It's keep things going that you used to belong to. I love helping people, and I just... this is history that people should know.
You gotta be a football hero to get along with the beautiful girls.
This story came from an audience question as part of the Wisconsin Project. Submit your question and we might answer it in a future Wisconsin Life segment. Go to WPR.org/Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast, wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, Color in the Outdoors is a group working to bring marginalized people into nature. The founder of that organization joins the show coming up next here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Now it's National Park Week, and despite some dreary weather today, it's still a good time to celebrate by getting outside. A Wisconsin-based group is focused on getting people in the outdoors, especially encouraging marginalized groups to enjoy the natural spaces around us. The group, called Color in the Outdoors, advocates for diversity, accessibility, and inclusivity, and works toward equitable access in outdoor spaces. That includes a wide range of activities, including hiking, fishing, foraging, and spelunking, among many more. Christopher Kilgore is the founder of Color in the Outdoors and a UW alum. Christopher, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
What did you see out there that made you want to start a group to work on these things?
Well, I guess the easier way to answer that would be what I didn't see. ever since I was a young child, I spent the majority of my time year-round outdoors when at all possible. And I grew up in Madison, grew up right in the center of town, and more times than not, the people that I was spending time with and the people I was surrounded by didn't necessarily look like me. And it wasn't necessarily noticeable as a younger child, but as I got older, it definitely was. And so as I was able to be in a position where I could start acting as a mentor or a role model of sorts with some of the younger folks, but also just as a peer with folks my age and some older, I decided it was in my best interest, not only to just be able to have folks to spend time with outdoors, but also to continue that legacy of handing that information and that passion for the outside world down. And as people kind of continue to give me nudges with their elbows saying, you really need to do something more organized, that's how Color in the Outdoors was essentially born.
What are some of the biggest obstacles for people of color to get out and enjoy nature?
Well, I think that there are, you know, the list is long. Unfortunately, I think accessibility is one thing. I think that oftentimes the spaces that we tend to recreate in outdoors are often far away or often kind of sequestered in an area that isn't necessarily accessible. So things like bus lines, things like transportation can provide a barrier. I think another thing is, again, to that point of seeing faces that look like you or seeing people that look like you out on trail. When you're in certain parts of the state, certain parts of the country, certain parts of the city, even oftentimes you don't necessarily see representation on those levels. And so it sometimes can be a bit daunting or intimidating and can therefore create some barrier in and of itself that way. I think that the more we see even things like signage, things like when there's kind of print and with social media being the way that it is in this day and age, the more representation you see in those spaces as well, the more likely people are going to be feeling more comfortable in outdoor spaces.
As you mentioned, Christopher, people elbowed you and tried to get you to do a more organized effort. In turn, how do you encourage other people to get engaged in this effort and stay engaged?
I think one of the biggest things is to just, you know, and it's easier and sometimes said than done, but just really do it. Get outside, grab some friends or family, figure out what is your comfort zone initially. And one of the things that I think we really need to make a point of saying is outdoor spaces include your front yard. They include going outside the door. And then that is why, indeed, it is called outdoor space. And I think that to that point, having friends or family, peers, colleagues, coworkers, take a walk in the park, take a walk down the street, observe the outdoor space in a way that you might normally not. We're so plugged into electronics and busy schedules these days that we typically don't literally spend time smelling the roses and seeing the forest for the trees. Then there are also just quite a few organizations, not only locally, but regionally and nationally, that are doing their best to continue to try to offer these opportunities up for folks as well. So, you know, we have these wonderful spaces on the internet where you can Google looking for different affinity groups or different organizations. And there are quite a few out there within the social media realm alone that are definitely offering up some fantastic programming and fantastic times outside and in outdoor spaces with groups and with people that are like you.
Now, suppose somebody's listening who runs a local parks department in a community or maybe a state park or whatever level. How would you suggest they kind of inventory and see what they can do if they're thinking, yeah, this sounds great. I want to make sure my park or parks are accessible to everybody.
Well, I think that, you know, one of the biggest things that I encourage folks that are in charge of spaces like that to do is to do an inventory, and not an inventory by themselves, but an inventory with affinity groups, with focus groups, things like that, where you can say, do you feel welcome in these spaces and what could we do differently or better? I think that to that point, anytime a space says, no, we don't need to do that, chances are they really need to do that. So I think that that's one of those kind of self-check situations where it's important to reach out beyond perhaps your circle or bubble and ask folks how they feel and if they indeed do feel comfortable and welcome. And then if the answer is yes, then what could they do to help encourage others and to get the word out?
We're talking to Christopher Kilgore, founder of Color in the Outdoors, also a UW alum. Christopher, are there, I don't know, wins, big or small, that you can point to or even in process right now where you think, yes, we've really moved the needle here?
I think, you know, from a more local, Wisconsin, we'll use that as our parameter space. There are a lot of things that on governmental levels, both within city, county, state government, folks are starting to see that this is indeed an important conversation to be having. There are some efforts being made to that point of showing inclusion when you have brochures and print material. When it comes to for instance, the Department of Outdoor Recreation has done a wonderful job of putting together a booklet with representation and intentional representation. There are also other organizations and entities that are starting to do the same. So I think to that point of wins, there are individuals, for instance, a friend of mine, James Mills, who is a guest lecturer at the Nelson Institute at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, my alum. I would be remiss if I didn't mention those types of things. But also other organizations. There's an author, Danae O'Dowd, who has written several books with representation of kids of color in the outdoor spaces. There's organizations like Outdoor Afro, Latino Outdoors, et cetera, where we've got, you know, there are more and more organizations and groups doing that and more organizations being brought to the table. And I guess I would say to that point, it's not just having a seat at the table, but it's also having a cup, a plate, a knife, a spoon, and a meal. Not just having a voice, but being actually included in the conversation in a longer term and a sustainable way.
At the structural level, I know there were points in American history where cities might be building lots of parks and overwhelmingly building them in predominantly white neighborhoods, not so much in predominantly black or Latino neighborhoods. How do you start to tackle a bigger problem that's already built in like that?
Well, one of the things that I, you know, if I were in a perfect world and part of a city planning division, if you will, I would say that not all spaces that are going to be quote unquote renovated, torn down buildings, and not all should be turned into parking lots and high rises. We definitely need more accessible green space. Those green spaces that are within city limits and city parameters, I think it's also extremely important that there's funding and efforts being made to keep those a place that folks want to be and keep those places being a welcoming space. Even as something as simple as signage and having signs in languages more than just English. There are a lot of folks from a lot of different walks of life. I think we'd also be remiss if we didn't talk about the acknowledgement of having most of the parks, that, for instance, in the city of Madison, all the parks in the city of Madison being on Ho-Chunk land and having some sort of nod to and an affirmation in talking about those types of things too.
Christopher, just very briefly, it looks like winter outside, but it is spring in Wisconsin. Springtime, what are you most excited about when it comes to getting outdoors?
Well, you know, with springtime comes flowers, comes the budding of trees. There's lots of foraging to do in certain areas where mushrooms start to pop up and ferns start to come out and that kind of thing. The birds are starting to come back. BIPOC Birders of Wisconsin and Color in the Outdoors are going to be doing an event in June, trying to get folks outside with their optics and their eyeballs and trying to find the birds that have decided to come back, including those that have stuck around. So lots of hikes to be had, lots of wonderful things to be done. Fishing season opens first week in May typically, so that's coming up. Just a lot to be done with the weather warming up.
We'll leave it there. Thanks to our guest, Christopher Kilgore, founder of Color in the Outdoors. Tomorrow on Central Time, speaking of birds, we'll visit Wisconsin's bald eagle population. That and more coming up tomorrow on Central Time. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then the Federal Reserve might run the risk of accidentally triggering a recession as it tries to tackle the issue of inflation. An economist tells us why that is. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, states around the country have recently passed new abortion laws. We'll check in on the status of abortion access in the U.S. and where it could go from here. First, inflation numbers are still on the high side, according to the latest federal numbers. And that has the Federal Reserve looking to slow down inflation growth in part by raising interest rates. Just one problem in some of the recessions over the last 60 years or so, one contributing factor may have been interest rate increases that were made in part to fix inflation. The economy is also in a weird place. It's still lagging because of the pandemic, supply chains still messed up, and the war in Ukraine, something economists couldn't have anticipated, has increased food and energy prices. So could anti-inflation efforts put us at risk of a recession? You can join in at 800-642-1234. How has inflation affected your finances over the last few months? Have you had to cut back on, say, driving because of high gas prices, or cut back on, you name it, whatever item you're seeing the price go up on? Call 800-642-1234 with your experiences, your questions. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Tara Sinclair is a professor of economics and international affairs at George Washington University. Tara, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's great to be here.
Well, I want to do a little 101 here. We always hear the Federal Reserve, when there's inflation, one of their tools is they raise interest rates, and that's supposed to slow down inflation. Can you connect the dots between those two things for us?
Sure. Well, I think a lot of people are already seeing those dots connected. When interest rates rise, the cost of borrowing goes up, and therefore mortgage rates are higher, auto loans are higher, credit card rates are higher, and that gets us to cut back on our spending. And when we cut back on the spending, then there's less money chasing the same amount of goods. So that slows the temperature of prices.
Is that something that people expect to work this time around, or are all those special circumstances I just listed, pandemic, war, supply chain, does that make this a whole different animal?
Well, it definitely makes it tricky, but it's still the case that the Federal Reserve has a lot of power and can raise interest rates enough that it will slow down our spending at some point. And the question is how quickly they will do that and at how much of an economic cost do we have to bear in order to bring inflation under control?
And there's that the cost, the risk of doing this. Seen a couple articles lately saying, hang on, when the Fed does this, raises interest rates to combat inflation, recessions follow. Maybe that caused the recessions. Is how big a risk is that?
That's a real risk, and that's something that a lot of different organizations are already starting to keep an eye on. And in fact, the Federal Reserve Chair, Jay Powell, has even pointed out that this is something that has been a concern in the past, and the Fed is really trying to be careful this time and bring, you know, a smooth landing to the economy. But they don't have a great track record, that's for sure. And so it's definitely a concern. And one of the things that I've been thinking about recently is with all the turbulence in the economy going on, the Fed is trying to engineer this smooth landing, but the runway is really moving around a lot.
There's been some criticism of the Fed for not doing this sooner. The idea being, I guess, if they'd done it over a longer period of time, raising interest rates, done it over a longer period of time, done it more gradually, that would have smoothed that runway a little bit. Is there something to that?
Well, they were facing a lot of different complicating pieces of information. I think if they had known how long the pandemic was going to last and how consumers were going to respond to all the different aspects of the pandemic, I think maybe they would have done policy slightly differently. But I think we all would have done things differently if we had known what 2021 and even into 2022 were going to look like. It's really hard to know in advance, which is what they have to do in order to make policy.
We're talking to Tara Sinclair, professor of economics and international affairs at George Washington University, looking at rising inflation, what the Federal Reserve can do about it, interest rates, the risk of a recession. You can join in with your questions, your concerns at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Steve is with us in Chippewa Falls. Steve, hi.
Hi. Yeah, I'm wondering about what we did in 1982 when they raised the federal funds rate to 20%. Mm-hmm. And there was only $1 trillion in national debt, but now we have $29 trillion in national debt, and we have to continue to borrow and service that debt. Can they even, what if they did that again? What if they tried to beat inflation by raising interest rates? Would it blow the federal budget? Would the cost of servicing our debt go through the roof? And so are we between a rock and a hard place that we've never been before?
Steve, thanks a lot for the call. Yeah, people have pointed toward maybe the deficit isn't such a big deal and the debt that he was talking about because interest rates are so low. Is he right to be concerned if interest rates go up that debt becomes a bigger issue?
Yeah, Steve brings up a great point that we do have to be concerned as taxpayers about what the rising interest rates mean for our tax bills, because we do have a very large debt and servicing that debt is one of the things that our tax dollars goes to. So the really interesting thing here is I don't think we need to worry about interest rates going up anywhere near as high as what we saw in the 1980s. The Federal Reserve is saying that they think that the neutral interest rate is somewhere, maybe they'll hit 2.5%. But still, that's going to be an increase in the cost to servicing our debt. I don't think we're going to be put in a position where we're really going to question these economic choices, but it's definitely going to be a bigger bill.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Yeah, Tara, when I look at charts of interest rates over the last five decades or so, the thing that's really striking is how low they've been for the last bunch of years, mm-hmm. especially starting in the Great Recession. Have they been too low, if there's such a thing?
Yeah, well, there's a lot of debate amongst economists on this one. There's definitely the camp that sees that interest rates have been too low for too long and that we would have been better off with normalizing interest rates much sooner. But there's also the camp that says that we needed to keep interest rates low in order to get to as healthy economy as we have now, and that we wouldn't be seeing the 3.6% unemployment that we're seeing right now without those super low interest rates.
We're talking to Tara Sinclair, professor of economics and international affairs at George Washington University, about anti-inflation efforts, whether they could risk causing a recession. We'll talk a little more about what recession is, what it means, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you remember about the most recent economic recession? How did the Great Recession of, what's that been now, 12 plus years ago, how did that affect you? Are you worried about it happening again? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas at WPR.org with your thoughts, your questions. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk with George Washington University economics professor Tara Sinclair about the relationship between inflation, efforts to reduce inflation, and the risk of recessions. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you feeling the effects of inflation directly in your life right now? What questions do you have about how to bring inflation down, how all this works? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls now. David is with us in Madison. David, hi.
Hi. Yeah, my question is, the government pumped a lot of stimulus checks out directly to consumers. I'm wondering if there's a history of that ever happening and how that affected inflation with our economy.
David, thanks for the call. A question I think on a lot of people's minds, Tara.
Yeah, thanks, David. So we have in general responded to past economic crises with some sort of stimulative policy from Congress. You know, that's something that Congress members want to show their voters, that they are taking action when the economy is in crisis. But it is true that the spending in response to the pandemic was unprecedented. And so, of course, at the same time, you know, the economic risks were also unprecedented. So the question is, which one was bigger and what did they know and when in terms of being able to make this policy? And I think a lot of economists looking back at the spending that was done find that perhaps that was too much spending and that that might be contributing to some of the higher inflation that we're seeing today. But at the same time, it was very hard in the moment as policymakers were putting these packages together to figure out the right size. And one of the lessons that we learned from the global financial crisis and the Great Recession was that it was possible to have a very slow economic recovery out of a deep recession. And it was very clear to policymakers that they didn't want to make that same mistake again. And so maybe they went the other way this time and went on a bit strong.
David, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Tara, let's get back to our Economics 101 here a little bit. I think we all get the sense that recession equals bad when it comes to economy. Can you get a little more technical for us there?
Absolutely. I think one of the key things that is different about the way economists talk about recessions versus the way I think, you know, the everyday person talks about a recession. You know, I think every day we just say a recession, we think the economy's bad. But economists think much more specifically about a recession happening between when the economy peaks and then when the economy bottoms out. And so we were out of the recession from the COVID crisis in April of 2020. We only had a recession for 2 months of 2020. But of course, the economy was still quite in rough shape. After that, it was at its worst in April of 2020 and then was climbing up from there. And so we've now called that time, we've been in recovery. But I think, you know, most people would have said we were in a recession through all of 2020. I still hear a lot of people say that they see even now that we are still in an economic recession, even though that's not officially the way it's defined.
Right. Even if we're not in a recession, it can take a while, as you were saying, to recover, including things like job numbers that went really, right, really slowly after the Great Recession. How did things compare after the brief recession following the pandemic?
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing. The recession was incredibly brief, but also incredibly deep. And yet we saw a very fast recovery out of it. We were originally expecting, you know, economists pretty much across the board were expecting it to take quite a while for us to get back within spitting distance of the unemployment rate we had seen in 2019. But we're already there. 3.6% unemployment is right about the point where we were in 2019. And so from that perspective, the economy looks like it's recovered a lot. But on the jobs perspective, so if we look at the flip side of that, we look at how many people are employed today, you know, there's still some room for getting back to the trend that we would have been on without the COVID, you know, hitting our economy.
We focus a lot on inflation in the media. I think in the public, it's understandable. There's also a lot of, at least what looks like good news, as you're saying, unemployment getting lower, job growth seeming to get back on track, a lot of demand. That's part of why we have inflation, a lot of consumer demand. How do you sort out the good news, bad news, and the yeah, but side of the story?
Right. Well, I mean, we all dream of that Goldilocks economy that is, you know, just right in temperature to where we see that the, you know, jobs numbers are good, but so are the inflation numbers. But that's a very, very fine tightrope for policymakers to walk. And at the moment, you know, their focus is definitely on the inflation side. And that's something that's really hurting a lot of people and families. And so that's something that I think we do need to focus on right now. Although we also want to keep in mind that things could have been bad in other dimensions if we hadn't had the type of policy response that we did during the pandemic. People could have suffered a lot more during that part of the economy.
Now, there's one of the wild cards I want to focus on a little bit here, something that the Federal Reserve can't really touch, and that's the supply chain part of things, where for a variety of reasons, from a shutdown in Shanghai to pent-up consumer demand to slowdowns in production because of the pandemic originally, how big a factor is the supply chain issue in something like our current inflation?
Yeah, I see that the supply chain issue is a big part of it. That's something that is impacting certain sectors, and we're definitely seeing that in terms of the prices in those sectors. But it also spills over to other areas as well, because, you know, if you are fighting hard to be able to get, you know, just one part to go into the cars, then that also affects the entire production of the cars, but then spills over to the production of other types of goods. So you can imagine that this can have a really big impact. And this could also mean that the Federal Reserve actually has to slow down the economy even more, since they don't have the ability to impact those prices. They have to affect demand for other goods and services in order to bring those prices down even more, in order to have an overall average inflation rate that fits their target.
Looking over this next year now, what kind of things are you looking for from the Federal Reserve when it comes to how they nudge up this interest rate?
Right. Well, the big discussion is, are they going to do a larger rate hike in May? They're definitely going to do a rate hike in May. The question is, how big will that rate hike be? And there seems to be a lot of signals that it's going to be twice as big as the rate hike that they did in March. They're talking about doing half a percentage point or 50 basis points, as they describe it, in May, and then maybe again in June. And so really the question is, how much do they raise rates over the rest of the year, and how quickly?
And as we've seen over the years, there can be political pressure on the Federal Reserve. A sitting president in any kind of election year, for example, doesn't necessarily want to see those rates go up really quick. How much is the Federal Reserve subject to that kind of federal political pressure, whether it's a President Trump or a President Biden?
Okay, so this is a really interesting political time, because right now, we would typically think that there'd be pressure for the Fed to keep interest rates low for all sorts of reasons. But because people are so upset about inflation and it's so high at the moment, there actually seems to be more pressure for the Fed to raise rates more quickly than we would think, particularly in an election year.
Tara, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Tara Sinclair, professor of economics and international affairs at George Washington University. She talked to us today about the Federal Reserve, interest rates, inflation, and the risk of recessions. Since the start of this year, Republicans in state legislatures nationwide have introduced more than 100 bills that could negatively affect transgender youth. Similar proposals in Wisconsin have stood little chance of becoming law with Democratic Governor Tony Evers in office. But as Christine Hatfield reports, transgender youth here still do feel the impacts. Parents and children shared their stories with WPR's Why Sconson?
Bailey Mosling of Middleton considers himself Wisconsin's premier drag teen. Right now, he's working on decorating a pink motorized toy truck that he's going to use for a birthday drag show later this month.
I'm a pro. Hey, calm down, everyone.
On stage, he goes by the name of Nemo.
My performances are, like, thought out and have, like, a storyline and are, like, very, like, theatrical at some points.
Off stage, Bailey is like many other people his age. He says growing up is hard enough, but as one of the estimated 150,000 transgender teenagers in the United States, he faces challenges many other teens don't.
It's an interesting thing to have, you know, like, my rights and like my like identity be up for debate.
Earlier this year, Republicans in the state legislature introduced a bill that would ban any sort of gender-affirming care for minors. That could include taking medication that delays the onset of puberty and hormones like estrogen and testosterone.
It was like a few weeks after I'd started hormones, and so I was like, oh my god, I spent like all this time just for it to be like taken away from me. And so I was scared, yeah.
Bailey says he first found the language to describe himself in a book he read in the sixth grade about a gender-fluid teenager.
1 minute after I finished it, I, like, went back to the first page and, like, started reading it again. And then, like, after I read it again, I remember putting it on my mom's, like, pillow or something and saying, like, can you read this?
Bailey's mother, Dana Mosling, says there are many hurdles in getting gender-affirming care for minors. Bailey started to socially transition in seventh grade, but it took a year to start puberty blockers. 2 years later, he started testosterone.
There's a reason that it takes that long, right? And a lot of it is, you know, making sure that you have the correct providers that you can have that those kind of relationships with.
Dana says all the work Bailey has done means he knows more about himself than many of his peers. And it's been freeing for him.
There's no longer this insane need for discovery or figuring things out, and you can then just unfold and exist, right? Exist and unfold and develop, you know, into the human you are going to be.
Now she says politics are getting in the way.
The fact that our kids' existence is this political debate right now, I mean, that's a stressor that most families never even have to deal with.
Megan McDonald is the executive director of LGBTQ advocacy group Fair Wisconsin. She says many major medical associations agree that gender-affirming care is safe and medically necessary for the physical and mental health of transgender children.
There's no reason why that needs to be, you know, random strangers in the legislature should be allowed to weigh in on that.
Wisconsin's bills focused on trans youth are going nowhere for now, but they could be reintroduced next year when split control of government is far from guaranteed. That makes Bailey nervous.
If it were to be like that, these like bills passed and I can't get the like care that I need, then like a physical part of who I am like wouldn't feel right.
Bailey says his identity isn't political to him.
We're not like trying to like change the world or anything like that. We're just like trying to live just, you know, in the way that feels most comfortable for us to live.
For now, Bailey's trying to focus on finishing 10th grade and figuring out what he wants to do after graduation. He's also looking ahead to that birthday drag show. Christine Hatfield, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up after the news, new abortion laws are going to affect in a lot of states. We'll learn about the efforts to restrict access in some places and expand it in some others. Of course, you can join in with your thoughts, your questions, what you would like to see or not see happen here in Wisconsin. Remember, you can follow conversations like this all the time, anytime, anywhere, online at WPR.org. And go there to live stream the Ideas Network and our other Wisconsin Public Radio networks. And you can go through our archives there to find, re-listen, and or share past conversations with your friends and family. You can also do all of those same things with the Wisconsin Public Radio app. Get it on your phone wherever you find apps. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network.